Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is episode number 15 of the Driving Eureka podcast. The discussion is about Doug Hall's newsletter from January 31st, 2019. You can read the newsletter by going to DougHall.com. On the menu, click newsletter. This week's feature article is Test the Untestable, Three Principles for Smarter Innovation Decisions. The Driving Eureka book segment is about data-driven decision-making, and the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy will discuss the topic, new data, new learnings. And of course, we'll talk about the craft cocktail recipe. So let's start with our feature article, Doug. It's Test the Untestable, Three Principles for Smarter Innovation Decisions. Why did you start down this path?
Well, you know, you go to a company and you'll be meeting with the small company, medium, large. And at some point, they'll lean in and they'll say, you know, we're a very conservative company. And I said, oh, that's surprising. I mean, I'm waiting to hear the company. We're not very conservative here.
So what do they mean by conservative? What are you gathering?
We don't do rash things. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we're practical and prudent as we do it. I would joke. The fact of the matter is that most of them are actually high-stakes gamblers. And the reason I say that, because that may seem harsh, is I say, so that would mean you use data to make decisions. Oh, yes, we're very data-driven. Okay, so when you made the decision to do that new system, product, whatever it might be, what data did you use? Well, we didn't actually use data on that. I said, what do you mean you didn't use data? Well, we couldn't get data. I mean, that was just not measurable. And see, this concept that it's unmeasurable is something that, you know, quite frankly, 10 to 20 years ago, that was true. You know, there were many things that you could not quantify. And so they were right. The fact of the matter, though, is that as computers and as one who had an Apple IIc up, as computer power has come and as new methods have come, what we're finding is that there is nothing that we cannot provide data on. Hmm. Now, so it is possible, as we say, I've got a team at the ranch, which is called the Merwin Decision Support Group, where we sell services to support. Now, I'm going to tell you how to do it, and we can also help you if you want, but I'm going to lay it out. What we found is that you can test the untestable. I mean, that's the slogan we use with people, and we have to be that blunt to get through because people have come to accept I can't make a decision. So, you know, I oftentimes joke, I say, you know, you have CFOs who don't support innovation. Well, guess what? That's because they're sane. They're reasonable people. You know, data after data shows that when it comes to an idea – now, I'm just talking about ideas to go to market, and it's also internal innovations as well. It's the same thing. But when we talk about ideas to go to market, 85 to 95% of the time, the idea is still not in business 2, 3, 4 years out. It fails. Oh, the first year, they may spend a lot of money to get it going, but fundamentally, it just withers away. Now, small businesses, they don't go away. They just keep it down at a small level, and it just kind of runs out. But to say that, yes, that has improved shareholder value, that has helped the company grow, we've got an 85 to 95% failure rate. So when the CFO says, I don't think we should do it, they're right. Hmm. They're right. The nutcase is the one who says, we should go for it anyways, even though we failed every other time we've done it. This time, it's going to be different. This time it's going to be different. Now, the fact of the matter is it is right to be conservative, with shareholder money. It is right to be prudent. But just saying it isn't doing it. What you have to do is you have to become data driven. In fact, being data driven is the fundamental to not only increasing speed, because when you have data driven, you get into less debates. And when you're data driven, you make less bad decisions. And in fact, just as an example, we have a research tool called Truth Teller, and it's a unique system. We don't have to get into the details of it, but fundamentally, what the system shows in the long-term tracking studies, we took decisions that were made by senior executives at the, you know, Fortune 100 companies. And then we had Merwin's, the Truth Teller system's evaluation, go or no go, basically, should they do it or not? 7 times more likely to make a smart decision, either to kill it or to go with it, when you used the Truth Teller system versus human judgment. 7 times. That's not 7%. That's 700%. Okay? And so, you know, you start to get into that 5 to 15%, you can see how you can get over 50%. You can win more than you can lose. It's very doable. It's very doable.
Okay. So you're taking basically this 85, 95% failure rate, and now let's say the failure rates, because you said it was wasn't your success rate is going to be, let's say, 40%. I don't know.
No, it's, or 50%. So, 50%. You know, my goal is always to win more than I lose.
Okay.
And because then, I can get to 80 or 90, but the way I get to 80 or 90% on each idea is I make them less unique. And so I don't get the return. I don't get extra pricing. I don't get extra margin. I don't make more money. Mm-hmm. So much more than 50% on innovations, when you're really trying to, you know, grow your organization, make more money, because, you know, if you're not unique, you better be cheap. Much more than 50%, and I think you're playing it safe.
Okay, so let's just take 50% for, you know, and I guess you tell me if this is a good analogy or not, but, you know, if I'm a baseball player and I'm hitting, you know, 0.05 or 150, then I'm not a very good batter. But if I'm hitting 300, I'm awesome, and what you're talking about is basically hitting 500.
That's right. Okay. And the key to that, and the key to making money on that, is that you have better data all the way through the process. So data is not at the start. The most important data is through the development process and as you're going to market to see how things are going on, so that you can make mid-course corrections. Because remember, set it and forget it. Create the idea and just go. That's delusional. Because as you go through the process of development and as you get into the marketplace, things change.
Okay.
And so competition adjusts. You're trying to engineer something. The technology doesn't work. You have to make adaptations. The biggest, the stupidest thing in the world is to test the idea at the front and never test again. In fact, one of my ways to understand the success of a company is I don't even have to know their success rate. If they just tell me, but this idea that went out, what tests did you do? What data did you gather on the performance of the idea, of the appeal of the idea? And they say, well, we ran a test in the beginning. Okay, so show me that thing. And they'll show me like a write-up or a mock-up or a prototype or a CAD drawing or whatever it might be. And I say, now let me see what you actually did. And of course, the two don't have anything to do with each other because it changed. Mm-hmm. I said, well, when you made those changes, did you test? Oh, no. That's not testable. Well, yes, it is testable. Yes, it is. The new methods allow you to do it at literally, you know, 10% of the timing and cost. Okay. We can do that.
Okay. So in some of the neuroscience research, for instance, that I've been doing, there's a book, it's called Decisive, and some of the things that I've read, there's 4 things that really block in a leadership team. And these 4 things are, and help me figure out once I get through the 4, how this helps mitigate these 4 things. So 1 is narrow framing. So they're not looking at enough options. They just have, it's kind of a go, no go type of thing. We got 1 idea. We're going to either go or no go with it. And I think you kind of hit upon it already, but we'll go back and revisit it. There's confirmation bias, which is then you're only looking for things that support your idea when you're doing your research. Emotion plays a large role in the decision-making process with executive teams, and then overconfidence in their idea. So how does this system, when if step back and look at those four things, the narrow framing, the confirmation bias, emotion, and overconfidence, overcome these difficulties that seem to manifest themselves in almost every organization?
Well, I'd put all of those, a way I would gather all of those is it's called ego.
Okay.
I mean, it's fundamentally ego.
Okay.
It's the narrow focus is I already know what it is. Mm-hmm. And I already know what it is, so I don't need to see anything different. I love it, so don't you love it? And of course I'm right because I'm right, because I'm the big boss, and I wouldn't be able to do this if I wasn't the big boss. I mean, that's the, you know, that's called HIPPO, the highest paid person opinion.
Okay.
They call it, you know, and so it's just different ways to say that they don't have a culture of learning. It's a Mr. Know-it-all or a Miss Know-it-all. Mm-hmm. It's a person who feels that they know the answer and they don't need anything else. And that's fine. And so that's why chief financial officers don't want to do it. And I, by the way, I hope that as a shareholder of your company, I hope you don't, because you're actually going to lose less money if you don't do it. I mean, I know companies where they would lose less money if they stopped all of their innovation. I mean, and that's absurd from a guy who wants to do innovation. But we've either got to confront this reality and become data driven, or we've got to just stop the innovations. Just stop them. Stop deluding ourselves. Stop lying to ourselves about this. And just run it as efficiently as you can. Run it off until you get bought up, and then go on to the next thing.
Okay.
That's cruel.
Okay.
Cruel, but true.
It's
cruel, but true.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to make freaking decisions, I mean, I ran into this big time because we work across at the Eureka Ranch. We work in so many different industries, whether it's oil drilling rigs. I mean, frick, I don't know anything about that. Millennial products. I don't know anything about that. And so what I've learned over the years is two things. One is I don't know what I don't know. And second, the more unique you are, the more likely it is to be wicked good or wicked bad. And so if you want to stretch the edges, you have to have a humbleness and let the data guide you. Not you put out stimulus and you get data on it, and then you learn, and then you pivot, and you keep doing that.
Before I move on to the next segment of the book segment, how do I know when I need you? So, for instance, if I've already got an idea out there, and people are struggling, and even in the Driving Eureka book, when you start to talk about these things, you talked about where someone had called you in, and they were looking to help their team, and it was already too late. But so you know, if you're not on the front end of coming up with the ideas, and you haven't built some of these things into it, can you help a company that's in the middle of an idea and they're struggling with it?
Well, they're struggling or not, it can always be better. And so you've got to put a foundation underneath it. And there's three fundamental principles that you need in order to be able to do this. And if you've gone along and you've gotten maybe a good run, but now you're running into bumps, or even if you're not, you got to have a foundation underneath the idea that you're doing. And so the three principles of today associated with smarter innovation decisions are, first off, you've got to build your systems so you can test at the speed of decision making. Okay. In the past, we would have a false sense of precision, and we would take a long time to put tests together, to run them, to analyze them. Well, then it's not worth testing, because you got to make a decision. And especially when you have lots of iterative decisions, you have to go faster. And the good news is that by using some of the new technologies and some of the new digital technologies and the new artificial intelligence systems that exist, that you can cut the timing and cost by up to 90%. In fact, one multinational that we work with found that they actually cut it by 93% versus the classic cost for them to do this. Hmm. And so you've got to build speed, because the longer it takes to do a test, the less likely somebody's going to go get data. So you got to vaporize the time and the cost. Whether you use us or other systems, you got to vaporize the time. You got to do it fast. The second thing you got to do is we have a tendency to want to look for the magic test, this one test that's going to answer it. Well, in carpentry, they call it measure twice, cut once. And I say measure twice or three times, decide once. Which is that sometimes there isn't a test, but you can triangulate on it by using different methods, whether it's Delphi, artificial intelligence systems, rapid research, truth-teller. I mean, there's different methods you can use that can triangulate for you to get a sense on it. You can get perspective on your thing from two or three tests that you look at. Remember, research is decision support. It's an aid to your judgment. It will not give you the answer, but it makes it so that you can make a smarter decision. So testing at the speed of decision making, measure twice or three times, decide once. And then the third thing is you've got to confront reality by using risk adjusted forecasting. So there's a tendency in the Western world to want to know the answer. How much are we going to sell? How much are we going to save in money if we do this cost savings thing? Well, if you do it and you hit that number, then somebody cheated, because the number you're not going to do is that number, because there's variance in that number. And I'm sorry, folks. I understand that you didn't like the statistics course. I understand you don't like standard deviation. I understand that you don't like uncertainty. You want to know the number. Well, you're going to have to get over yourself, because uncertainty is fundamental to all of these measures. I mean, we're projecting the future. And the way to get smarter instantly, is to do risk-adjusted modeling, where you're modeling using the standard deviations, using the variance, using Monte Carlo simulations, five-year trial and repeat, diffusion models. And if you don't know those words I'm saying, go hire somebody that does, or rent somebody that does, because you got to do it, okay? If you don't, you're at a disadvantage versus others. I mean, we had NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, literally validated our forecasting system the first time ever for forecasting technologies in federal labs, I mean, which is about as difficult to do as anything in the world. But you can quantify these things. You can bring it, but you're going to have to model the uncertainty. And what that does is it gives you risk adjusted. When you do that, you end up in a situation whereby, whether you're a commercial company, a consumer company, a business thing, I mean, we once did a thing with the EPA. They wanted to put in regulations for refrigerators, and they wanted to know if they put this in, how would it impact sales of refrigerators? Was there a consequence to it? And we found there wasn't, and they did it. I mean, refrigerator design changes by regulation. We can model that. Do not tell me that you can't. But if you turn around and you have a high-speed system, people are going to use it. If you use multiple measures, and if you use probability modeling, risk-adjusted forecasting, then you can dramatically reduce your risk. It is a no-brainer to do this. I'll tell you, though, that it starts with somebody saying, I need to learn more, because they didn't teach you this stuff in school, because it's new, folks. You go to your research people, they don't know about it. It's new, folks. This is a new world that exists now, that is now starting to go, and it's built into the innovation engineering movement. It's built into the tools. We can help you, but there's other people that can help you. Get the newsletter. The words that I put in here, people know what those mean if they're in statistics. And if you don't get statistics, get it. Rent it. Because, you know, failure is your other option.
Okay. So, and I know I falsely promise that we move on to the next segment, but I got to ask the question. So when you say triangulate on decision support data, can you dumb that down a little bit for me? What exactly are we doing there?
Well, so say you're looking at a situation whereby you've got a idea going to the marketplace, but you've got a route to market that might involve distributors and industrial companies, or distributors, retailers and consumers, or fundraising, major donors, then minor donors and government grants. You might have two or three groups that truly at the end of the day are the fundamental dimension. And so one way to do this is that you do an assessment of each of those groups to see what's the probability that each one of them is going to open up and support you? That's one way. Another way be is like when I was talking about the EPA. With the EPA, we had to use a collection, the truth teller system, which is a calibration system. We had to use consumer data to go do it. And we had to use both of those numbers, and we got two different measures of it. And then we used the variance between those two to do our modeling.
Okay. And were the numbers then very far apart? And so you
sometimes
you got
they
a range?
Are. Okay. Sometimes they can be very far apart, and sometimes they can be very close. I mean, we'll do tests where we'll take the idea and we'll test the communication clarity of it, which impacts what's going to happen. At the same time, we'll score consumers' first opinions on the idea, which gives us an opinion on the thing. And then we might turn around and use the truth teller system, which gives us a more business model thing to say, does this whole idea have the scale that we need to do? Sometimes those will all come the same, which gives us a high confidence, and sometimes they'll have high variance. Now, you say, oh, geez, you got high variance. That means the tests aren't any good. No. It means there is high uncertainty. Hmm. I mean, just even measuring your customers. I can take customers and ask them on a 0 to 10 scale how likely they are to buy it. I can get, you know, four, everybody comes in 4, 5, 6. Or I can, and I have an average of 5.5. I can also get a 5.5 with a whole lot of ones and a whole lot of nines. Okay. And what we found in the past is when you have that high variance, people say, well, obviously it's a polar idea. Well, interestingly, when we match that with clarity research, we find the idea isn't clear. The person giving it a 9 is interpreting the idea one way. The person giving it a 2 is interpreting it in a different way. And so when you combine clarity research with the consumer research, I now get a better sense as to what's going on. And sometimes we can then fix it. I mean, because the first thing you want to do is you want to fix it. You want to make it work. But sometimes we have to accept the fact that we don't know what we don't know. And we're going to have to see what happens in the marketplace. So we might need to run a test market first before we scale up.
Okay. And then that informs then the judgment types of decisions associated with that particular product and how it's moving forward.
Yeah. You make decisions on your investment strategy. Are we going to build a big factory, or are we going to, you know, work with contractors to do it for a while before we find out so we can mitigate our risk?
Okay. And so the two paths for the Eureka Ranch are basically the one is you can come in and help them, you know, come up with these data, or two, you can teach them how to use these tools.
Well, that's right. But the first thing is that just take the newsletter, take it to somebody that understands statistics, and you can have them help you. Okay? You can just do that. I mean, the stuff I'm talking about, probability modeling, multiple measures, speed through digital systems, those exist in the world. We happen to be experts at it, and if you need help, call us, and we can help you do it. But that's really up to you.
Okay. Let's move to the Driving Eureka book segment from here. It's time now for the Driving Eureka book segment with author and inventor Doug Hall. So now we're talking about problem solving with data-driven methods, which is obviously the subtitle to the book, Driving Eureka. We're talking about reducing fear. What fear are we reducing?
Well, with all new ideas is fear. Fear of the unknown, fear of failure, et cetera. And we know that fear has a direct correlation on your organization's ability to create, communicate, and commercialize big ideas to make stuff happen. And there's two fundamental ways to reduce fear, as I write in the book. And as you mentioned, I mean, it's important to note that the book's subtitle is the book is Driving Eureka, Problem Solving with Data-Driven Methods. So you might notice I'm a little bit passionate about this stuff. Okay. I mean, it's like people say innovation is too risky. It's like, duh. If you don't have any data, yeah, it's not just risky. It's stupid. Now, when fear happens, there's two ways to do this. The first thing is to make the unknown known. And as I write in the book, we do this by writing the idea in a very clear way for the customer or the stakeholder. What's their problem? What's the promise we're making? And what's the proof that we can do it and the cost with it? Okay. Mm-hmm. As well as a math game plan that says how the hell we're going to either save money or make money. Okay. So pretty simple. First thing is make sure we have clarity of what the idea is, because we may all be talking about a different idea, and you find that over and over again. Define the idea from the perspective of the stakeholder in the case of systems and the customer in the case of, you know, products or services, improvements or whatever it is. The second involves the data, which is doing what's called the Deming cycle, or plan, do, study, act, or PDSA, where we use rapid experimentation and we gather data, and we use data to guide our decisions. You know, plan, do, study, act is not a wandering in the wilderness thing. It's the plan, the do, and the study. And the study ideally is against something factual, and more factual than data. And so we use that to do that. And what we find is, when you embrace this, when you have teams of people together, fear has an exponential kick in the number of ideas. The lower your fear, the more likely you are to create, communicate, and commercialize meaningfully unique ideas that can make a difference for your organization. So we want to drive out fear, and we do it by making the unknown known and by adopting the cycle of plan, do, study, act, and that means data. I know Deming said the most important things are unknown and unmeasurable. That was true in 1980. It's not true today. With computers and probability modeling and Delphi and artificial intelligence systems, we can put quantification on these things.
Okay.
That's true reality.
Okay. So, you know, as I – and again, I want to reference back to the story you tell in Driving Eureka, which was the water – a company. They had a way to filter water, but they'd only run one test really at the very beginning, and then nothing for I don't know how long, but it was a long time. And as I'm listening to you talking, is one of the biggest problems that you run into then is the fact that they tested idea at the beginning and then they never run a test on products or new services again in the development process?
Yeah, and sometimes – and so that was an example of – I met with them in the morning. I'd been brought in by senior leadership. The team had been going for 18, 24 months. I can't remember. And it was not going anywhere. And they said that they could filter water that made it taste better than bottled water. I said, spring water. I said, well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. I said, how much better? And they said, well, we don't really know. I said, what do you mean you don't know? I said, well, we don't really know. I said – and this is a big campus. I mean, this is a big company. I mean, there's like all these buildings everywhere, you know, with B1723, you know, the kind of places.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Rooms. And I said, well, you got a cafeteria here? And they go, yeah, we got a cafeteria. I said, oh, that's cool. A lot of people go there. Oh, yeah, a lot of people there. I said, what do you say we go out and get some spring water and get yours, and we'll just set up at the cafeteria and just have them taste A and B, do a paired comparison, see how we do. Oh, we can't do that. I said, why can't we do that? Well, we couldn't get the water. I said, well, I got a rental car. I can go get it. They said, well, no. We'd have to get permission. I said, at P&G, I used to do this stuff all the time. I mean, they think it's cute. No, we can't do it. And they came up with every objection, most of which made absolutely no sense. And I finally came to the conclusion that they didn't believe their product was better. Hmm. Inherently, they did not want – Tim Feely at Procter & Gamble once taught me we'd run a test and the test bombed. I mean, I put a team of three. We put 9 products on the market in 12 months. And the reason we were able to do that is because of the exactly what I'm talking about, by the way, folks. So this is my life. This is my life. And we'd been devastated. And Tim Feely, product development, just a genius of a product developer, well, all retired now. I mean, he came in and he said, numbers are our friend. He said, this is a great moment for you. Now you know that doesn't work. So now get ready and do your next one. And it was funny, but it's like, confront the reality now or later. Well, they didn't confront it. And 6 months later, management did, and they shut them down. And they didn't need to. Because even though maybe their product wasn't better, they could have done I'm going to go geeky on you now. Sensation transfer to find out on what traits were they winning and losing, which is the easiest test in the world. And I don't know what's happened. I mean, let me tell you this. If it's your organization, you don't do paired comparison and sensory transfer, then you are at a major disadvantage. You are at a major, major disadvantage. I mean, just freaking call the ranch and have us just do a presentation for you on what this is. But you got to start doing it. You got to start doing paired compare. The problem is you can't. SurveyMonkey won't let you do these things because they don't have those things built in.
So, time out.
People don't know how to do this. They don't know how to do the statistics. They don't know how to do it because we've become simpletons. And I'm tired of people telling me innovation doesn't work when they're not using the skills of the state of the art of today. And don't tell me that's the way we've always done it, because that's the way we've always done it. It's never worked. So stop doing what you've always done, because it's not working.
Okay. Well, we've talked about one of the two things you just mentioned, but I'm not familiar with sensation transfer. What is that?
So what sensation transfer is you set up two offerings. So as an example, we might set two whiskeys. Mm-hmm. And we might take a really expensive whiskey that costs two to three times what our whiskeys cost. We'll have them test product P and product Q, no identification. They say, which one are they more likely to buy? Which one is more new and different? And then we'll ask them, which one has a better aftertaste? Which one is richer? Which one feels like it would taste, would be more expensive? Which feels like it's older? Which has a greater smoothness to it? A collection of traits associated with whiskeys. And then what you find is you find a couple of things. One is you find where, if you're losing on the overall measures, you find what the things that you're really losing badly on. So, you know, like our smoke product, you know, in the beginning, what would happen is we'd say, which one has a better aftertaste? And we would get flushed. I mean, we'd lose like 10 to 1. It's like, okay, we got to fix that part. It points you to where you're strong and where you're weak. And it gives you a better sense. And by the way, it's obviously times fun for us because, you know, here we're taking this young juice that we've used time compression on, and we're winning 2-1 and 3-1 on tastes older, tastes more expensive against okay. more. And that's seriously cool, man. That is seriously cool when we do that.
So what's the difference then between a paired comparison test and a sensation transfer?
Well, with sensation transfer, it's just an expanded paired comparison. So the paired comparison, okay. You do it, but then you put the traits down and you keep doing the comparison between the two, and you use that to do it. You can also then turn around and do a regression with it, which we do automatically in our software, which can tell you what are the factors that are driving appeal. What are the things that are driving people to like it better, them or you? What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? I mean, and this is deep information. Mm. Much more than saying, what do you like and what do you dislike, which just tends to be imperfect. This is really good, solid data. I mean, frankly, that's why within a year, we won 2 of 8 double golds at the North American Bourbon and Whiskey Championship. It was because of paired comparison. I mean, it's not like we're geniuses. It's just we are data driven, and most of the entire industry. I mean, I've tested more whiskeys than anybody on planet Earth. I mean, I did stuff for Diageo, for Edrington. We've got by far more. We have the biggest database in the world on whiskey testing. And you know, this is one of these where the data captures the rich get richer and the poor stay poor. I mean, you know, that's just the way it is.
And I remember, for folks that are listening, in episode 7, we talked about paired comparison testing and the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy segment and how much of a differentiator is. And the fact that, and you mentioned in there, Doug, about the fact that companies aren't doing these things, and how crazy it is, which you, by your voice, indicated the same thing. But I just wanted to mention that these are things that companies can do today to differentiate themselves and improve their products that they have out in the marketplace.
Well, and I one of my New Year's dreams for this year is to get on this issue. And so to that end, and I've been ranting about it so much that Maggie Nichols, the CEO of the Eureka Ranch now, she's actually started up, at various points we've had it, a market research group, which is the Merwin Decision Support Group. She's just started that group up again, because while we teach people to do it, what we're finding is there's a whole lot of companies where before we can even teach them, we've got to just show them. Mm. And we've just got to do it. And so we have a new and she's just hired a lady, Vicky, who's just amazing, from one of the top research firms in the world, one of the world's experts at forecasting. And so with her and Greg and different things, we've got a whole team where we can just come in and just do it for you a la carte, because we've got to do something about this. If we don't get towards data, then everything else we're talking about with innovation engineering, everything else we're talking about is not needed. Because if you don't do data, then it's just the same stupidity we've always had. And so then just put some design foolishness on it. That's not going to solve the problem. Facts and data are a friend, as Team Feely says.
Okay. So, and that's the reason this team's been assembled then, is to help organizations come up with decision data so that they can make better decisions.
Yeah. We think of it as a three-step process. The first thing is they'll do a la carte. Mm-hmm. They'll have a test. They'll have us do some tests for them. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing they do, we've put together a package where it's a monthly package where we show up on a regular basis and just push them to do more testing and to help them do it. And when we do it that way, we're sort of – it's halfway between that and teaching them how to do it. We're enabling them to do it. And that cuts their cost by 70 or 80% for the tests. So we literally are taking the cost of us doing the test and cutting it by 70 or 80%. In the process, we're enabling them so that they can sustain it. Okay. So, and then we go all the way to if they want to learn innovation engineering. But it's a stepwise process to meet people where they are. I mean, you got industrial companies that have never done research in their life, really. I mean, they've called it research, but, you know, show me the statistical significance and the standard deviations, and now you're doing research. No standard deviation and no statistical difference, and that's not quantitative research. And qualitative's nice, but I wouldn't bet on that.
Okay. And the one last thing I want to cover off before we go to the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy is you show, I don't know if this is the effect of fear, a meaningfully unique ideas that are invented. Low fear groups, you say 42, medium fear groups 34, high fear groups 31. How does this fit into what we're talking about?
Well, this is just a measure of teams when they were creating meaningfully unique ideas where we tracked them. And this was a fundamental study that Dr. Chris Storman and I did. That showed that the impact of fear was massive. Literally, people would shut down in the face of fear. And so it's a torture test that just shows that this. Now, other people have shown the same thing, but to see it so striking in a group of people in the process of creating ideas, same pattern, same groups, this was done over many years. It was pretty significant. And if you think about the cumulative effect of that, it gets even worse.
All right. Well, let's move to the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we will take you behind the scenes so you can see what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company with patented technology like has never been done before. New data, new learnings. We're on this theme of data. And so this is your practical application of using data in the whiskey business so that you can demonstrate actually how this stuff works. So what are you learning here?
So, last weekend, we ran a huge test of whiskeys and whiskey cocktails. We had a huge group of people. They tasted them, and we went at, it was 18 cocktails, 12, 14 whiskeys. Some people did both. Some people did one, and we did micro testing samples and so that they weren't drunk. We already took care of that. And so we ran the test. And it's interesting going into the test because, you know, you have hypotheses of what's going to work and what's didn't. And we found some cool stuff. Some things confirmed and some challenged some others. And some have created open questions that we don't know about.
Okay.
So we found that our four core whiskeys actually appealed to different groups of consumers. And so there's a very different profile for the people that like, whether it's the Edrington set of Relativity, Noble Oak, and Noble Oak Rye, and the Smoke product, or it's our Riverboat collection, is there's a very different profile to those. And that, so that was cool to learn.
So are those four offerings then that you just mentioned, is that broken out? Does it happen to break out by, barley, wheat, rye, and
well, there's differences in them, but the big point is it's different people. So what happens is it's the light to new whiskey drinkers, mm-hmm. Like the Relativity product massively more. And the Noble Oak product really appeals much more to those who want richness, and so a way to think about it is, and I'll talk about this in a minute, but just red versus white wine. In a simple sense, Relativity appeals more to white wine drinkers. Noble Oak appeals more to red wine drinkers. The rye product appeals more to IPA drinkers, the strong IPA. I mean, it's just very fascinating to see the dimensions, and we've got more analysis to do, but we're putting together a three-dimensional profile. We're running now t-tests across them, putting together a profile, but they are distinct. And in fact, the way I say that they appeal to different groups is we took the appeal of the four and we ran what's called a correlation matrix, where you compare them against each other.
Okay.
And the appeal of each product doesn't correlate with any other product. So the people in general who like one are different than the people that like another. And that's what it tells us that. So, what we're saying is that they're different. And so that means they bring different customers in.
So would it be fair to say that they're kind of separating themselves into groups, like you in your example of red wine versus a white wine drinker?
That's right.
And
that's right.
Maybe even subgroups from there.
Yeah, there's psychographics to it, and are they a cocktail trendsetter and different things like that. And we're putting together these profiles for them. But the neat thing is, I mean, it's like if Relativity and Noble Oak co-correlated, as the person who liked one also liked the other and who didn't like it like the other, then you'd say, well, one of these products isn't needed because it's the same customer. But they don't. None of the four correlate with each other. They're all different. And so these are different markets. So we know this is a good business decision to have four products. You always look at it and you go, do I really need those four? Is there one I can get rid of? No, they're four different groups of consumers.
Okay.
The second thing we confirmed is while only 18% of people in the U.S., and this is from a gargantuan study, okay, so this is real data. Don't say it's not true. It's the fact. Only 18% of people in America in the last 12 months drank whiskey. 18%.
Is that any whiskey, whether it's neat
whiskey,
or mixed?
Any whiskey. Okay. Anyway. Okay? Mm-hmm. By the way, 18% drink whiskey. 20% of those drink it neat. So that would be 3.6% of the American population drink whiskey. Let's just be specific here about this, okay? Get over yourself. 90% have a whiskey cocktail they love. So we had a wide group of people that didn't drink whiskey. And what we found is there is a cocktail that works for 90% plus. And, whiskey puts a depth in cocktails that you don't get from gin or vodka and that kind of stuff.
Okay. So just for clarification, is that 90% the 90% of the 18% or 90% of the population?
The 100%.
Okay.
And we were also surprised that, and we've got to dig deeper into this, but there's a cocktail called the Sazerac, which I don't think we've done yet.
Yes, we have. Yeah,
oh, we did. Yeah. Okay. Well, Sazerac is a top. I got to make a list of all the cocktails we've done.
Yeah. We need to put a cookbook together.
I know. We got to do that. I should start to pull them out. But the Sazerac is a New Orleans classic. It's a very boozy cocktail, but it's got a really good balance to it. And against other boozy cocktails where they dropped off, the Sazerac had a much broader appeal than I thought. And so it made me think that we've got to think deeper. We can't just stereotype and say a boozy cocktail where there isn't, it's not like a highball with a lot of liquid in it or something. It's not going to appeal to non-whiskey drinkers. It is possible to get them, but you've got to have more balance to it. And there's a balance that's in the Sazerac. Now, some people like the licorice taste. Some people don't, which is a different issue. But there is There is more potential for cocktails than we understand, so we have to think about it. Now, surprise, and that was a surprise. Another surprise is that, so we have this dream to create this whiskey wizard that guides people to the right whiskey and cocktail. And, you know, I had some people at the ranch saying, this is never going to work. I mean, it's this way. It can't work. But we found that some things you'd expect, like frequency of whiskey drinking, preference for scotch versus bourbon, very different profiles of the products that people drink. Yeah, and things like and then we found some things that I would not expect. The red wine versus white wine that I talked about. That literally sent you. I mean, literally the four products I talked about, you're going from white wine to deep red wine. You know, the big Cabernets. I mean, it's almost like I can ask you what wine you like or what kind of beer you like, and I can tell you of my four whiskeys which one you should try. I mean, it's spooky. It's spooky. The same thing with Whiskey Trendsetter. We asked people, are you asked for your ideas and advice on cocktails? And sure enough, that will point you towards different ones. Do you like hot and spicy food? That's going to point you to certain cocktails. I mean, interestingly, hot and spicy food, there's a famous cocktail in New Orleans, and again, New Orleans, a great drinking city, Brennan's Brandy Milk Punch. And the team, the Brain Brew crew, did a twist on this where they did a bourbon milk punch, but where you use half and half, which I'm going to talk about it in a minute. Well, let's talk about it. the bourbon milk punch, where we replace the brandy with bourbon. And so we'll take an ounce and a half of Noble Oak bourbon, 2.5 ounces of half and half, you know, the cream, an ounce of cream of coconut. Shake it and then put some shaved chocolate on the top of it. You know, just grate some chocolate bar onto the top of it. And so, you know, the bourbon milk punch, brandy milk punch is classically simple syrup and vanilla. In place of simple syrup and vanilla, we use cream of coconut. In fact, Lydia Carson of the ranch actually invented this thing at an event that we were doing. And it's amazing. And people who liked hot and spicy loved this cocktail.
Really?
Now, hey, I'm thinking that they need the cream to cool down the heat or something. I'm not sure what it is. But, you know, and I would never have guessed that. I would guess that people that liked hot and spicy would like the smoked whiskey. I would guess that. But I would never have guessed the bourbon milk punch. And it was also the number one cocktail with non-whiskey drinkers. And I would never have gone there. And they loved it. In fact, during the tasting, what happened is we happened to make up an extra batch of it. And as we were going around, we had this big room of people, I don't know, 70, 80, 90 people or something like that. And so we're serving them glasses out at the bar. We're making the stuff up. And I went by the tables and like at three different tables, they said, you got any more of that one? You got any more of that one? And I went out and I guys got any more? Oh, yeah, we made an extra batch. I bring it in, and they literally passed it table to table as people drank more.
It was popular.
It's a killer. And I would tell you, craft distillers out there, make the Brain Brew Bourbon Milk Punch. Make the Bourbon Milk Punch. Try it. Try it tonight. If you do nothing else, I don't care if you hate whiskey, get yourself a nice craft bourbon. I'm always going to support the craft guys. Or get our Noble Oak Bourbon, which comes from a craft company in partnership with Edrington. Get the Noble Oak. And some half and half cream of coconut and rock on, man. I mean, it's incredible. It's
all incredible. Right. Well, I'll have to try that one too. Just a note, it was episode 9 or newsletter 9 that the Sazerac recipe was talked about. So if folks want to go back to that, they can go back to episode 9 and listen to the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy segment, or they can listen to the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast and get it from there. One of the two.
I also want to mention to folks, I know there's a lot of folks in the craft industry or there's people that are thinking about creating their own whiskey. We will be in Minneapolis for the Craft Spirits Association is having its annual conference in there. It's called American Craft Spirits Association, the ACSA. It's a 6th annual conference for distillers. And that's in Minneapolis the 10th, 11th, and 12th. Of February.
Oh, wow.
And we'll be there. The Brain Brew crew will be there. In Minneapolis, we've got a booth there, and we'll be talking to folks. And if you'd like to connect, love to have you come by. That's 10th, 11th, and 12th, the ACSA, Distillers Conference in the Hyatt Regency in Minneapolis.
Okay, we'll be sure to put a link out there to that in the show notes then too. Very good. Well, this was interesting. We went into quite a things. I'm sure we're going to revisit some of these things on data as we go into future newsletters and episodes of the podcast. But we got a little of everything there. We got, you know, the issues associated with the data, the fact that it's out there, and now we have also got using the data, you know, applying it to the whiskey. So very good.
Excellent. Well, the whole year, we're going to be focused on data. That's my focus.
Okay.
Let's get smarter.
All right.
Okay. Thanks.
Is it time to use artificial intelligence and innovation forecasting? We believe the answer is yes. The Truth Teller system shows evidence of picking winning innovations 7 times better than executives in thousands of research tests. Be sure to look at our show notes for this episode to download more about the Truth Teller system, or use go.drivingeureka.com/truthteller.